Okay, so it's last day, almost last talk, so thank you for being here. Especially because we are going to move back to microbes, which after these few days talking, at least from my virus-centric perspective, listening all these talk about Drosophila and things like that is like
strange organism.
yeah, too big, too complex. I don't know why you guys don't put all your brilliant minds and ideas to some more interesting system like a virus. I don't know why Drosophila, really. It's horrible. Anyhow, we don't do anything related with ecology. I mean, we do very simple laboratory experiments or greenhouse experiments, but there is no real ecology there. So among the different things we do in the lab, I choose to tell you about something which might be somehow far away related with an ecological problem in virus virology or a virus ecology problem. This is the evolution of resistance and virulence in host and viruses. This is a fundamental problem in virology, understanding why viruses evolve virulent in some cases, whereas they are not virulent or pathogenic in other cases. They are more temperate and mild. What are the mechanisms, the evolutionary mechanisms, that drive the evolution of such relationship between the virus and the host? Our experimental systems, the ones we use today, right now in the lab, is a plant virus, different plant viruses, and natural and artificial hosts, as you will see along the talk. So that means that along the talk, the examples I will give you are basically plant viruses, always. Some of the things I'm going to discuss and I'm going to present, myself or other colleagues have also tested on animal viruses, so they are kind of general results in the sense that they are reproducible or the conclusions are reproducible for animal and plant viruses and also in some cases for bacteriophages. So they are kind of general conclusions that can be drawn from several such a different systems as animal and plant viruses. So the topic today, basically what consequences has on the virus dynamics the fact that hosts are not all equal in susceptibility to infection. So not all of us are equally susceptible to influenza. Some of you guys probably get influenza once per year, and some other, if you are lucky, never. So there is variation in our genetic constitution that made us more or less susceptible to infections. And this is a universal thing. Plants are differ on their susceptibility to different pathogens. I mean, even bacteria do, so everything is, there's lots of differences in the response of hosts to infection. And what these differences in susceptibility to infection have on the evolution of viruses. So here I'm just listing some of them, yes, to start discussing, no? The host heterogeneity in response to infection might select for monomorphic generalist populations of the virus. So basically, one option is that the viral population or the pathogen population in general evolves as a generalist, so they can infect every possible genotype of the host. That's a possibility. Another possibility is that the pathogen might evolve as a response to the diversity, the heterogeneity of the host, as a polymorphic population that is composed by specialists. Each one is good infecting a particular host genotype, but is bad or not as good infecting other hosts. So as a whole, the population will be generalist, but each individual by themselves is a specialist. Or the third possibility is that the viral population might evolve as a monomorphic population composed by only one specialist on the most abundant susceptible host. That means that basically there is one host in the population, one host genotype in the host population that is susceptible, and the other are resistant. This is kind of a, I mean, it's a really unlikely situation, but it's still a possibility, conceptually. What the outcome, what these outcomes depend on something, and what is the dependence of these outcomes? Well, there are a bunch of considerations to make. One possibility is that the relative abundance of productivity of each host genotype. So if one particular host genotype is, when it gets infected, produces more viral particles, then the viral population as a whole will be enriched on those particular viral genotypes. So that means that that whether the host produces more or less will determine the composition, the genetic composition of the viral population. The rate of transmission or gene flow between host and I'm assuming always that the host population is a single large population. Okay, I'm not dealing with small patched populations that then transmission will be more difficult in that sense. But anyhow, in general, transmission rate will determine the outcome of the evolution of the viral population, and whether co-infection and superinfection are frequent. That means that if you have kind of a, if you increase the chances that two viral particles, two different genotypes, co-infect or are present at the same time in a given host, that increase the strength of selection on the viral population. That means that you will even further select for genotypes that are more efficient replicating and infecting particular hosts genotype. That's basically what they say. The heritability of the host range, in other words, whether when a virus gets adapted to a host, basically the progeny of that virus is always adapted to the same host, or there is lots of new genetic variants being produced by the viral population that are also potentially good infecting other different hosts. And finally, whether there is a trade-off in the fitness of the virus across different hosts. Okay, and I'll came back to the trade-off idea in the next slide. So basically there are a bunch of how the viral population will evolve on in a way or another will depend on a bunch of different things. Some of them are inherent to the viral population itself, to the viral genotype, or they are more dependent on the genotype of the hosts.
So from the perspective of a plant virus, what is host heterogeneity? Is it different plants, or can it be different parts of the plant?
It can be, no. For this talk, let's say that host heterogeneity is different plant species or different plant genotypes. Okay. You'll see later, but this particular work is mostly is Arabidopsis thaliana and different genotypes of Arabidopsis thaliana. There is different heterogeneity within a plant. There are different tissues, different cell types, different developmental stages, and the cells respond in a different manner to infection. Okay, but I'm not going to treat that particular point today.
Yeah, I was just wondering whether there's a certain circularity, because you start with the assumption that there is heterogeneity mm-hmm. in the host, mm-hmm. but doesn't that depend on the virus? So
it depends on the virus, and it depends probably on the pathogen pressure on the host. Any pathogen make a pressure on the host.
Right.
The host might evolve resistance that are specific of a particular pathogen or a universal resistance.
I mean, right, so it might be that for some virus genotypes there's no heterogeneity, and then for others there is, they are heterogeneous in their response. That's what
do you mean the host is heterogeneous or not to particular viruses?
Yeah.
Maybe.
So
at the end it's
the virus might evolve in such a way that it makes the host homogeneous, so to speak, for that particular virus. Isn't that? Like, I mean, doesn't heterogeneity, that's not an internally given thing, an externally given thing. That depends on the virus population.
Right. The virus population, obviously, or any virus population might drive the evolution of the host. That's true.
But I mean, even the definition of heterogeneity would depend on on which virus, even genotype, is there.
Yeah, true. Yeah. That's true. Let's move a bit ahead. So in terms of virulence, at the end, when people study infectious diseases, what worry the most is the virulence, no? How much damage the infection produces on the host. Virulence is a kind of difficult term. I mean, not from the ecological perspective, not from the evolutionary biology perspective, if you want. Ecology is simply the reduction in the fitness of the host due to infection. That's easy, that's an easy definition. But you will be surprised if you deal with plant breeders or even medical doctors or people that really work with the host, what virulence is. I mean, there are all kind of weird conceptions about virulence. The amount of damage but on the host, or even the fact that the virus is capable of infecting a particular host, some people call that virulence. So there are different definitions of virulence around. But the one I'm going to use today is the reduction in, or let's say, the impact of infection on the ability of the host to produce new new descendants, okay? The fitness of the host. Basically, how much the fitness of the host is reduced by infection. Okay. Anyhow, so all these things about how the viral population might, how heterogeneity, host heterogeneity determines the evolution of the virus, what things determine this evolution, so all these things has somehow something to do with virulence, no? And there are some key points that I just that has been hypothesized. In many cases, these points are basically or are mostly theoretical derivation from a bunch of very smart people that do work on theory on the evolution of virulence. So for instance, it has been said that the strong host immunity might exacerbate selection for virulence. So that's a kind of I don't know, to me, when I first read this thing many years ago, it was kind of surprising. No, the host is increasing the defense, the host is increasing the response to infections, and that is selecting for more virulent pathogens. That's what theory says. I'm not sure if there was many data supporting that. Virulence escalates up in an homogeneous population. That's basically the observation when you do serial passages in vitro in a single host. Virulence always goes up. Is probably because you are decoupling transmission from mortality or transmission from damage to the host, but that's something that has been quite well described. An heterogeneous population cannot maintain virulence at an intermediate level in all host genotypes. That's also a theoretical prediction. It basically means that you have hosts that differ in susceptibility. Some are more, some are less. Virulence always has to maximize in all the individuals. It is enough with one of the genotypes selecting for a very, very virulent pathogen, so this will spread on the population. And again, and this is the second time this word, magical word, appears, whether virulence scales up or slides down to intermediate values depends on the trade-off between replication on different hosts. So again, the whether a host is more susceptible to infection and allows for more replication and for more damage, that will select for more virulent things. And that, whereas the opposite is true, a host that is not allowing, is very resistant, is not allowing for viral replication will do the opposite. So again, this is the trade-off thing. So trade-off is kind of implicitly implicitly involved in many of these discussions about the evolution of virulence and pathogens in heterogeneous host populations. So, and what is a trade-off? I mean, sorry, I probably don't need to make this slide here in this audience, but I give this type of seminars to all kind of audiences. I mean, more people that doesn't know anything about evolution. So, I have this line. So what is a trade-off? A trade-off means that a particular, this is the fitness of the virus or a pathogen, and these are host genotypes that are genetically less and less related, with, for instance, this one. The fitness of a virus or a pathogen that has been evolving in this guy is high on the guy, but as you get far, far, far from this guy in the genetic relatedness between hosts, the fitness goes down. The opposite is true for a virus or a pathogen that has been evolving on this particular host genotype. It shows high fitness here, but then as you get far, far, far from the host relationships, then it goes down. This will be to specialist pathogens. Each one is specialized in one particular genotype of the host, whereas a generalist virus, something like, will be something like that. It's a virus that do well in all the host, but they, it, in theory, never do as well as the specialist. Okay, it's the famous Jacob of traits. So you don't expect these guys, these generalist guys, to be as good as the specialists. That's what the trade-off hypothesis tells us. Okay, what mechanisms create trade-offs? Again, I don't need to probably to explain you these things. Antagonistic pleiotropy is the main one, meaning that whatever molecular interaction that has been optimized between the virus and this particular host genotype, if you change the molecular components of the host in some sense, the interaction will be not established correctly and the virus will not probably replicate as well as it does in the real host. It's just a question of optimizing the interaction between molecular components. There is a second option, which is called the mutation accumulation. If you have genes in the pathogen, if you have genes in the virus that are essential for infecting a particular host, H1 for instance here, but they are irrelevant in a different host, those genes, when the pathogen enters in the second host, will behave as neutral. They will be neutral targets, they will accumulate neutral mutations, and if the virus goes back or the pathogen goes back to the original host, those mutations are not going to be neutral anymore. Okay, this is the mutation accumulation hypothesis. This probably is more important for large parasites like bacteria with more complex genomes than for viruses, keeping in mind that viruses, and especially RNA viruses, they are really tiny things with non-accessory genes or not. I mean, every gene, every nucleotide in the genome of RNA viruses counts for something, so there is no neutral sites, let's say.
Can I ask you,
absolutely.
When you say fitness here, do you mean the performance within the host or within a host population?
Great question. For this particular slide, really I don't think doesn't matter. In the talk, fitness will be within a pathogen replication. It's the standard, you know, the standard way we experimentally measure fitness. So you have a reference strain, you mix them, quantify the initial ratio, and then track down the change in ratios. That's what fitness will mean from now on, okay, for the experiments.
It's not something like R0 or something?
No, the ones we measure, not. Here, I mean, I think it really doesn't matter, I guess.
I'm just wondering because, you know, like in general for evolution of virulence, I mean, as you
it's
well know, you know, matters like contact rates,
transmission,
and that kind of stuff.
Fitness in that context is R naught,
right,
in the epidemiological context. Right. Yeah. But this is more on the individual host level things. Okay. And the third possibility is an independent adaptation. So you basically have different targets. You might improve fitness in one, but not in the other if you are not under selective pressure to improve fitness in the second target. That means the two first imply that a mutation is beneficial in one side and then have an, or beneficial or neutral and then have a negative effect in the other host. The third one is basically they are beneficial or neutral, but never deleterious. So how much experimental evidence we have about fitness trade-off, about the evolution of specialists and generalists? This is a very old question in evolutionary virology. this is something that lots of people have been working on this. When Paul Turner was a postdoc in my lab in century ago, we already did experiments to measure, to evolve the specialis and generalis with vesicular stomatitis. It's an RNA, animal RNA virus. But today I'm just going to show you one example of a plant virus evolving as a specialis or generalis, depending on the dynamics of the host that is infected. So imagine that we have a very simple experiment, really, really simple experiment. You have a virus, which I'll introduce you the virus in a moment, but for now, just it's a virus, it's an RNA virus, really tiny one, that is isolated from tobacco. Okay, it's a tobacco virus. Yeah, you have the tobaccos. Then you can do an evolution experiment where basically you do serial passages of the tobacco virus in tobacco and then measure. In this case, the slide is showing virulence, doesn't matter, there's similar slides for fitness. So basically, if you plot virulence a long time for the tobacco virus, evolve in tobacco, basically it stays, there are these red lines here. They basically stay where they are, there's no clear trend to increase fitness. They are already adapted to tobacco, so you do further passages, they are okay. What happens when you take the same tobacco virus and you put in pepper, which is a different host? Then you measure the virulence of the virus and base, or the fitness, doesn't matter in this case, again virulence, and you see how the virulence starts going up. As it was already shown for many other viruses, including bacteriophages, RNA, animal viruses, when you do this kind of experiment, you always get fitness up. What happens when you take all these viruses and you measure their fitness / virulence in the alternative host? In this case, they have been evolving in pepper. This is pepper, so if I put them in tobacco, the fitness in tobacco goes down. Okay, there is a funky jump here, but basically, in the short term, things go down. So there is a kind of negative association between increasing fitness in one host and the fitness in the ancestral host. If I do the same experiment for tobacco, basically they do nothing. Okay, it's like nothing. This is another way of plotting this data, which is showing the rate of change in pepper, the new host, versus the rate of change in the ancestral host. And if you have no change in one host and no change in the other, basically all dots will be around this point here, 0 and 0. If you look at the tobacco, at the pepper evolved lines in pepper, basically they are above 0, meaning that they have improved fitness in tobacco, whereas they have, in pepper, where they have reduced fitness - virulence in tobacco, in the ancestral host. So basically, there is a evolution towards improving in the host that is facing the virus, and this is at the cost of reducing fitness / virulence in the ancestral host. Whereas the lineages maintained in the ancestral host, they basically do not respond to selection. They stay basically where they are. Okay? So yeah, when you have a single host, the virus evolves to become a specialist on the host. What happens if we complicate the experiment a little bit and then we alternate the hosts? If you take one day the virus produced by tobacco and then you put in pepper, next day you take the virus that came out from pepper and you put back in tobacco, and you keep the things alternating between pepper and tobacco. And then you do this for a bunch of lineages and then see the fitness or the virulence of the virus. Basically, this graph is showing you the evolution in tobacco. O sea, the virus evolved in tobacco, fitness in tobacco, fitness in pepper is what I showed you before, plotting a different way. So basically, there's no significant change. Whereas if you have the virus evolved in pepper, okay, when you measure in pepper, the round circles, it has high fitness, but it pays a very strong fitness cost when you put back on the ancestral. Okay, these two lines are the same that I showed you before. Now, the interesting thing is what does the virus evolve in the two alternating hosts? Basically, these lines are the squares, which are here and here, on this dashed line. So the virus evolved in the alternating host, does as well as each one of the specialists on the corresponding host. So they evolve as a generalist, but a particular case of generalism is a no-cost generalism. So they can be as good as the specialist on each corresponding host.
So the first experiment is, in some sense, a limiting case of the second, right? If where you basically switch between hosts, but very slowly, and you did like the first iteration. So that if you switch between, okay, let me ask it more simple,
yeah,
less involved. So if you switch between hosts on like larger timescales, mm-hmm. how reproducible is it to adapt to the host? Can you do that like, say, 10 times and go back to the original host? Or do you run into some dead ends?
Yeah, so if, yeah, I see the point. So, yeah, if you do, if I take the tobacco-only virus after 20 passages, and then I took it back to the paper, the fitness in paper will be low, really low. Okay? So in other words, if I do 20 passages of 20, I mean, if I do 1 day passages for 20, then that evolving a generalist. If I do one single passage of 20, that is evolving as a specialist, and it's not. So the number of generation probably is totally the same, but the outcome is.
If after 20 you switch back to the other host, does it recover?
Yeah. Yeah.
And can it do that very often? And then both experiments are somehow the same, just on a different scale.
Yeah, they will recover. They will probably recover, though I'm not sure if the time if. The molecule, the genetics will be the same. The molecular changes observed will be the same. I don't know, and the time. So I don't know, but probably my guess, and that's a guessing, it will be like repeating the experiment. I don't expect to see any big difference between evolving 20 times in tobacco and then putting in paper and evolving in paper. That will be the same than the original experiment evolving the ancestral in paper. Probably they will get to the same place. That's answering your question? I don't know.
Yeah, thank you.
I don't know if it's answering. So the key point here again is that if the virus faces the two hosts at equal frequency during evolution, then evolve as a generalist, no cost generalist. And there has been a lot of this. And this is not, this is a kind of, again, general observation with other viruses from animals and bacteriophages and things like that. So it's a kind of general thing for viruses, either because they reproduce so fast that even within a single passage, they are able of recovering every possible mutation, I don't know, which is what the virologists think, or because they retain a kind of memory or as a tail of mutants that are in the population at very low frequency, and you simply transfer them. And once you are in the new host, they simply sweep up in frequency very high. But the fact is that they don't really pay a cost. So this is a kind of experiment, very, very basic, trivial experiment to show that you can do evolution with viruses in the lab or in the greenhouse, and there is response to selection. And they adapt to one simple host, or they adapt to multiple hosts in different manners. So, but the big experiment I'm going to tell you is something that we have been working for many, many years, is in this particular pathosystem, in this particular combination of plant and virus, and is a virus called tobacco etch virus and Arabidopsis thaliana. Let me give you some hints on this system. Arabidopsis thaliana, I don't need to introduce, everybody knows Arabidopsis thaliana. Who doesn't know Arabidopsis thaliana in this room? Maybe a theoretical physicist never heard about Arabidopsis thaliana. But Arabidopsis thaliana is for plant biology the same than E. coli for microbiology. It's the plant with capital letters, okay? Everything is known about Arabidopsis. We have mutants for every gene. It grows fast, it's easy to handle in the lab, it's really tiny, so you can have thousands of plants in a reasonable small space. It's a convenient host. And the virus is called tobacco etch virus. It belongs to a family, which is called the Potiviridae. It's the largest RNA plant virus family. Contains hundreds of species of viruses that infect almost every plant that you can imagine. The genome is really simple. It's about 9.5 kbs RNA molecule, positive sense. That means that it is, when enter the cell, the RNA is immediately translated into a single protein. It's a very long protein, and this protein is self-cuts into the mature peptides. So it has proteolytic activities itself that, for instance, this is a HCC-Pro, it's a protease that cuts these two pieces apart from the polyprotein as they are produced. And then there is another protease here, NIA protease, that basically chops everything else into the mature peptide. As the mature peptides get separated and fold correctly, they start doing all kinds of things. They interfere with the defenses of the plant. For instance, this protein, HCC-Pro, is really important for the infection because it's what is called the suppressor of RNA silencing. This means it's a protein that blocks the defense response of the plant based on the RNAi, RNA interference. So that opens the virus the possibility to replicate and block the defenses. And this protein, I'm just mentioning three proteins. This protein here is the replicase, is the RNA-dependent RNA polymerase that needs to be produced in order to synthesize all the progeny RNA. And the third more relevant protein here is the CP, which is the capsid protein. This is a very simple virus. It's not icosahedrical or fancy. It's like this, it's like what you see here. These are the viral particles. They're like filament or things. Okay? They look very much like Ebola, but they are not Ebola at all. So as I say, TB the host range of plant viruses is always loosely defined, because if you go to nature and you find a virus in a particular plant, in the incidence of that virus in that particular plant species is high, then you are confident that this is a natural host for the virus. The problem is with cultivated plants. Usually, we pay more attention to cultivated plants than to natural plants, to wild plants. And they have been over-sampled, obviously, because it's what we are interested in. So people find viruses in cultivated plants, which are not necessarily the natural host, simply because they have been looking on the cultivated plants more intensely than in the wild plants. Or because people simply, there's an obsession in plant virologists to every virus that they take in nature, they go to the greenhouse and they check whether they infect anything they have in the greenhouse. Any plant that you can imagine. Yeah, they are artificial infection, artificial hosts that if you go to the databases of plant viruses, they appear as hosts, but they are artificial. It's what we do in the lab. I mean, this is not an Arabidopsis virus, and we do infections in Arabidopsis.
So can I just,
because
I don't know how this works, how is it transmitted?
Okay, so details on the biology of the virus. So this, as many as all plant viruses, they need a vector to be transmitted. Okay? That's the big difference between animal and plant viruses. And when I moved from animal to plants, that was my most naive expectation was, okay, I put the virus on the plant, that's it, will work. No. You need to introduce the virus in the cytoplasm of a cell, mechanically. In nature, there are vectors, insects. This particular virus is, the insects are aphids. Okay? Aphids. So basically the aphids, they fly to an infected plant. Usually the plants infected look yellow. They have these yellow colors because the chlorophyll is, the photosynthesis is altered and they have yellow color. This is attracting the aphids. So the aphids fly, land in the plant, and start punching cells to eat. And then when they punch a cell and sucks inside whatever is in the cell, they get the virus. And then when they move to another cell, another plant, they transmit the virus in the same way. Okay, they need to be mechanically transmitted.
So the more of those things they produce, the better, basically.
Yep. Yeah, the more dense a cell is packed with viruses, the more easy it is to be transmitted. Okay, so in nature, the dynamics of viral populations in nature are really complex because they depend on the vector. The density of vectors, the dispersion of vectors, the density of plants, you know, depends on many, many factors. But in our case, because we do things in the lab, we don't use the vector for transmission, okay? We do a trick, which is we do mechanical transmission with the hand and using abrasive powder. There is an abrasive powder called carborundum. It's used in the industry to make metal surfaces smooth. It's a powder. So basically, we mix the powder with a buffer, put the virus, put on the leaf, and using an ear stick, for instance, you just do this very gently, and the abrasive make lesions in the epidermis of the leaf, and the virus enters. An extremely efficient way of transmitting the virus. Okay, and we have done lots of experiments to quantify the infectious doses, what is the bottleneck of transmission. We control all these things. Okay. We try to minimize the bottleneck of transmission.
So you know, like, can you increase or decrease?
Yes, the bottleneck size on transmission, we can manipulate that. Yeah, that's easy. That's the easy part. So, well, after all this I just went away from the main idea. So basically, as I say, the host range for TB in nature is basically limited to the Solanaceae. Solanaceae are a big family of plants where you can find tobacco, tomato, potatoes, peppers, a bunch of other things. But basically, these are the most known plants on the family. They are economically important from an agricultural perspective. The artificial host, Arabidopsis, is a brassica. A brassica is like a cauliflower. It's the same family. Radish, cauliflower. This is a completely different family of plants. Both Solanaceae and Brassicaceae, obviously, they are phylogenetically related. At some point, they have a common ancestor, but this is back on the phylogeny of plants in the Magnoliopsida class, which is basically as far, Arabidopsis is as far from tobacco as it will be a human from a lizard, something like that. Okay? This is the type of jump that we are simulating in the lab. Okay? There are different classes within something. Okay, so it's a big taxonomic jump, what we are simulating in the lab. You might ask, why you choose to do this with Arabidopsis and tobacco edge? Well, there are basically two reasons, quite pragmatic reasons. One is that when I started this work, it was already described in the literature that tobacco edge can infect some ecotypes of Arabidopsis. And this is a new word that I'm introducing here. I don't know how familiar you are. Ecotype. It's a way of saying that in a particular environment, you have a particular genotype of the plant that is adapted to this environment. And they are genetically, they have genetic differences between ecotypes. Okay? That was one of the reasons. Second reason was that Arabidopsis is a convenient host to work in the lab because, as I say, we know everything about Arabidopsis. We can do very precise genetic analysis of what happened in the plant, and we can order from the Arabidopsis collection mutants to every one of the 22,000 genes the plant has. So you can order mutants, single mutants, double mutants, whatever you want. Or you can cross them and create your own mutants. That's really easy. And the third... And the third reason was that we have what is called an infectious clone. And this is the key for all the virus evolution work, to have an infectious clone. What is an infectious clone? I probably don't need to say that, but it's a plasmid that contains the entire genome of the virus. And if you do an in vitro transcription of the plasmid, that means you synthesize an RNA in vitro from the plasmid, that RNA itself is infectious. You can put the RNA on the plant and the plant gets infected, because the RNA has everything needed to start the infection. Basically, the cells translate in proteins, and then the proteins do the rest. Having a DNA plasmid, and this is, you will see now, also gives you a lot of power to do genetics. I mean, when you were discussing the other day, guys, that maybe there's a position that is adaptive here in this gene, because we see all this mapping, QTL mapping here, or whatever, and you do all these efforts to trying to really came to the point where is the beneficial mutation. For us, it's like trivial. You just sequence the virus, see what is different from the ancestral, go to your plasmid, do the mutagenesis, recover the mutant virus, and check for fitness. If it recovers fitness in the magnitude that you expect, that's because that mutation was the beneficial. Yeah. Kind of simple thing. I mean, that's one of the beauties of viruses as experimental system. So as I say, going back, Thaliana ecotypes differ in the susceptibility to infection, to Arabidopsis, to TB. This was work done by Jim Carrington and François Gevers in the late 2000s, or sorry, in the late 90s, early 2000s, and they found that they identify a number of genes they call RTM that are defined as restricted TB movement genes, so they block the spread of the virus of TB on Arabidopsis. There are at least three well-known, well-characterized, two that are not really well-characterized, and these are what they are. They are proteins involved in stress, and proteins involved in ubiquitination of other proteins and degradation. So these are the proteins, basically. So, and the genetics of the system is as follows. If you have a wild-type allele in all the five loci, wild-type alleles are the dominant ones. If you have the wild-type allele, even in heterozygosis, because they are dominant, in all five loci, the plants are resistant to infection. You can put the virus. The virus basically infects a cell, but never spreads.
So when you say spread or movement, that's again within the cell?
Within the plant. So they get out of the cell, go to the next cell, and then spread to the entire plant.
So but for that, they don't need a vector?
No, they don't need a vector for that. OK, back to the biology of the virus. So the virus enters in the first, needs the vector to enter the first cell. Once in the cell, do whatever it needs to do, produce protein, replicate RNA, encapsidates, and do all these things. And then this is a peculiarity of plant cells. Maybe you don't remember, guys, this thing, but if I draw this as a plant cell, okay, these are plant cells in the epidermis. So you remember the old your botany or general biology.
Yeah, I don't remember anything.
Anyhow, if you just take a magnifying glass and you look a leaf of a plant, you see the epidermis. Right. They look like that. Okay? The cells are connected. Okay? This is a difference with animal cells, which usually are isolated. The plant cells are connected. This is called these bridges here, or these holes in the membranes. They have a very complex protein structure. They keep open a hole, and this is called the plasmodesmata. And all the traffic, there's an active traffic of all kind of molecules, organic molecule like proteins, RNAs, or inorganic molecule like sulfur or nucleotides, things like that. They go as crazy. It's a complete traffic between the cells. And it has to do with the way plants grow. I mean, the leaves expand, they get bigger, and the nutrients go from the green leaves to the new leaves where the plant grows, and all this movement of nutrients on the plant goes through these things until they reach what is called the phloem, which are the veins of the plant. You see the leaf, they have veins, so the phloem. So basically, if this is the first infected cell, the virus replicates, accumulates, and then goes to this cell, replicates, accumulates, and then gets in the phloem. Because the phloem always goes up to the new leaves, the virus simply goes up with the phloem and infects new leaves.
And so when the movement is restricted...
When I say restricted movement, basically this is not happening. So they enter the cell, replicate, and they never move away.
So they can't... I mean, I'm just wondering, you know, whether it's possible to have like different kinds of... Like, you could imagine that you just have replication within the cell, or you don't prevent replication, but you prevent transport,
yep.
Or you know, you...
Yep. So these particular genes, what they prevent is the long-term spread. So basically, you can get one cell, maybe the second cell, but that's it. They don't go... They never get here.
Because there's some...
There's some proteins that basically do not recognize the virus. The virus is not interacting with those proteins, probably. These recognition proteins are not interacting correctly with the virus. So it's like a key and a locker. They don't interact correctly, so they can do the next step in the movement system. Okay?
So is it actually an active transport? They have to be recognized?
Yes, they need to be recognized and they need to be pulled. Actually, there's lots of information how they do. There's a lot of knowledge about how they do this thing, and it's a vectorial movement. So they basically take one of these things and translocate here, but once they do this in that direction, they can't do back. So it's like they are already programmed to do in one way, and they can never go back. So they do all these kind of fancy things.
So if you make artificial lesions, it can still spread on the same plant. So
yeah, if I do artificial lesions in a leaf,
yeah.
I will infect a number of cells,
yeah.
But if they are resistant somehow, the virus will stay on those cells, maybe move one more, but that's it. Okay. Even if by making the lesions I put them here, they will move up, enter one cell, and stay. Because they cannot go further. Okay, this is what is called local infection, but they don't have systemic infection, which means they don't reach the entire plant. Okay. So as I was saying, if you have wild-type alleles, the RTM, in all loci, you can't do systemic movement. But if you have mutant alleles, which usually are deletions of these things. When we have sequenced things, and these people already they say that, when you have they are usually long deletions in these genes, then basically you become sensitive to systemic movements, and then you can move. And because it was known that it was a particular ecotype, very popular in many laboratories, which is called Lansbury erecta, this ecotype is double mutant of a deletion in this gene, so it is completely susceptible. Again, it doesn't matter now if you have dominant homozygous alleles in these other genes, it is just one, this one is enough to allow movement. It's a complex genetic system, but it's the way it works. So, we start our experiment. This is going back to 2005 or 2006, something like that, when we started all this work. Basically, what we did was, okay, let's try to evolve the tobacco virus in Arabidopsis. Let's try to see how the virus adapts to a new host. So we took Lansbury erecta, because we knew it was susceptible to the virus. We took our plasmid, we infect the tobacco, we produce a large amount of viral particles, and then we inoculated hundreds of Arabidopsis with those viral particles.
How did you inoculate them?
Mechanically, with the hand. You only need two PhD students and a technician. They do. It's cheaper than buying a machine that does for you. Anyhow, so you do the infection. You wait and wait, and you don't see nothing. And the PhD students get crazy. We don't have anything. Oh. You say, don't worry. Just do a molecular diagnosis. See whether there's replication. And yeah, there are some plants that are infected. They don't show symptoms, but they are infected. A number of plants. So we collect the plants that were infected, though not system, not symptoms, but they were infected.
So by infected, now you mean
that? That means that you are able of detecting the virus in the upper leaves. So the virus spreads on the plant, but there is no symptoms. Symptoms came later, but now no symptoms. So you take the plants that are infected, homogenize them, collect the virus, and use it to transmit to the next. And then you, basically, for each one of these plants, we founded a lineage of evolution. So basically, this went to 10, this went to 10, and so on. Okay? So we allow infection, and then at every passage, just do the same trick, check whether they are infected. If they are, you take one, and transmit to the next generation, and keep doing it.
Wait. How, which plants, like which viruses do you select for the next generation?
Anything that is in the population. Basically, anything that has been produced in a plant, okay? You take the entire plant, so you take the entire viral population, which is about 10 to the 8, 10 to the 9, at these early stages. As they get adapted, the number increases up to 10 to the 12. And basically, you take everything, you make a sap, what we call a sap.
10 plants from...
No, each. I mean, if you have... Let's say that we infected 10 plants. Let's say that you have two that are infected. I mean, we inoculate, it doesn't mean they infect, but we inoculate. Imagine that you have two. You choose one, and this is the parental for the next. It's randomly, you choose one.
You choose one of those two?
Yeah. Randomly. No, just randomly, you will choose one. If you take five infected, we choose one. And this goes to the next generation. Okay? You can do that, or you can do a pool of all plants, and then that will actually that speeds the experiment. By pooling things, you speed the experiment. But at that time, we decided to do this way. We do pools now, but at the beginning, we were more ignorant. So basically.
Just to clarify, so you didn't check if you had like two, you didn't check which one had more?
No. No. It was a positive band in a Western blot. You see the dot, that's infected, boom, take that one. Anyhow, so some of the lineages got extinct because either they didn't produce enough viruses, so when we do the purification we lost everything, or because the number of viral particles were not enough to induce a good infection, or the plant at the end controls infection, we don't know. But the fact is that we lose some of the lineages, but some other continue, and after 17 passages, we decided to see how the best lineage, the one showing better things, looks like. So basically...
How long is one passage?
One passage is six, 7 days. It's slow. I mean, compared with cell cultures or E. coli and bacteriophages, it's slow. But it's a real multicellular complex system. So, anyhow, I'm trying to justify myself. So we took one of the lineages, what we call AT17. And I don't know why I put this ridiculous name. A year later, I said, why I didn't call it Darth Vader or something fancy, no? 8017. So, and we measure the pathogenicity, which is the percentage of plants infected with a particular amount of viral particles, and the load, the viral load, the number of infectious particles per unit per milligram of tissue, per whatever unit of tissue that you want. So this is the ancestral virus, where it goes. It has very low infectivity. So if you infect 1,000 plants, they get infected, I would say 200, maybe, if you are very lucky, 18, 180, something like that, out of 1,000. and the viral load. How many viral particles per milligram of tissue are produced? It's a very low. After 17 passages, the virus was here. 100% infectious. So you inoculate 1,000, 1,000 get infected. And with a titer, with an amount carrying, with the number of viruses per milligram tissue, like 2 logs more.
Okay. So is the infectious viral load more like a growth rate or more like a carrying capacity? So in the E. coli terms, like, is the whole plant, if the whole plant is not infected, right, it would be more like how fast does it spread in the plant? The other one, how many do you make in total, which seem to be different traits?
I don't know the answer to that. I would say it's a combination of both. I mean, they probably replicate faster because you see the symptoms. Now they are symptoms. Okay? So you don't need to be a plant pathologist to see. This is a plant inoculated with buffer. This is a plant inoculated with ancestral virus. It's hard to say there's nothing. And this is a plant inoculated with this guy. The same age, the same day inoculation. So I would say, the symptoms, I mean, 2 days after infection you see symptoms. So the virus really goes fast, moves fast, but it also reaches a higher concentration per milligram of tissue. I mean, total probably, because the plants are small, the total number is probably not too big because the plants are really small. But still, they are on, when you do qPCR and you count number of genomes, it's on the range of 10 to the 12 or things like that per plant.
Is 1817 now also working on the other accessions?
That's what I'm going. I'm going moving to that. Okay? This is a detail just for plant biologists. So that's a matter. So we were happy. We saw a response to selection. We got something that apparently has high fitness within plants. So let's sequence. So we sequence the virus. 9.5 kb's RNA, that's piece of cake. And then see how many changes you have in the genome. Well, basically you have 6 changes. That's it. That's all. 6 changes in 10 kb's, let's say. They are synonymous changes. There are 3 synonymous changes, 3 non-synonymous changes.
Every one of, like, so when you say you sequence the,
it's a kind of consensus sequence. You sequence the entire population as a.
So that doesn't mean that every.
No, they might, at this point they might be in different molecules, but at high enough frequency so you can detect all of them. At this point, okay? Let me give you the thing. So we went back to our plasmid and we make all single mutations, one by one. And then check for the infection. And then there's no symptoms. No. Okay? So this one was the only one producing symptoms. It's a non-synonymous mutation in the VPG protein. VPG is a protein that is involved in it interacts with the eukaryotic elongation factors during translation, so it makes a big complex of proteins and then starts transcribing the molecule into the complementary strands and then replication. Okay, it needs to make this complex to start making copies of the genome. Okay, makes sense. It's one of the key essential points to start replication. And then we say, okay, now we know this is a good one, but let's start making combinations of mutations. Let's make the double mutants. So here are just 3 double mutants, the non-synonymous, this guy with this guy, and the other one. So the 3 double mutants. And see the symptoms. Now see this guy, which is this here, this and this together, they produce no symptoms. This and this, they produce more symptoms, okay? And this, they produce more symptoms. Here is a picture, you can see. So this is the mutation in VPG, the mutation on VPG plus one of the others. You compare this plant with this plant. I mean, it's maybe hard, but you see that the stems are now like curving down, I mean, the stems here are still like straight, but here they're curving. And if you make the triple mutant, these three mutations together, this guy, and this guy together, this triple mutant, and you see the symptoms, the symptoms are as you expect. So when you put these three mutations on the same molecule, they phenocopy, they reproduce the symptoms of that you have observed for the...
How do you differentiate between a symptom that is severe and that other one that is really more severe? Do you have a...
There's a kind of a, it's kind of visual, semi-quantitative. You basically, I mean, you have to be trained to see the symptoms, how aggressive they are.
These pictures, right?
Yeah, they are the pictures. I mean, these are kind of representative, okay? They are probably the better things you can see. I mean, but yeah, here you see that this is smaller. You see the flowers are here, whereas the length of the stems is very short, the number of siliquots, which are where the seeds are, is much lower. So you can count more or less all these things and say, okay, this is more severe than this.
But is it delayed development that you have, that they start then flowering earlier, or what is the real thing? Because there can be many reasons why you get this.
Maybe. So yeah, they basically start flowering early. But they produce less flowers, less seeds.
Kind of, this is normal. This is a normal stress response that you have in plants.
Absolutely. Yeah. Not claiming anything.
No.
It's a standard thing. Yeah.
So I have one more question. Is it surprising that you see mutations in the replication part of it? Given what you said earlier about they can replicate fine, but they just have a hard time.
Or, well, maybe the thing is that they replicate. I mean, they replicate fine means that they replicate in the first cell. But if it, imagine that there is a kind of a threshold thing that you have to reach the threshold in order to do something. And if you are replicating but you are not reaching that threshold, the first step to increase your fitness is to replicate more within a cell.
Okay. Anyway, it doesn't seem like it's a key and lock thing with the transport.
Probably no. It's more a density thing. Yeah. So what, that was the key question, the question that really interested us at the time. Is the plant responding in a different manner to infection of the ancestral and the evolved viruses? So how the plants respond to infection? When you have a virus that is not adapted compared with a virus that is adapted, okay? So this has implications in terms of emerging diseases. So when you get Ebola, Ebola is not adapted to the humans, so it does these, all these nasty things. But what will happen if somehow the virus gets adapted? Will the cells respond in the same manner, or they will respond in a different manner? So that's kind of the question that we were interested in answering next. And to do this, remember, this was 2006 or around. So RNA-seq was not an option. So we use microarray. Actually, we still use microarray sometimes. I recognize that. We like microarrays. They are easy and cheap. So basically, this is a three factors experiment. We have plants not inoculated with buffer, plants inoculated with ancestral, and plants inoculated with evolve. And basically, we do, this is a bunch of plants, the average. And this is, the result here is kind of the average of a time course, but doesn't matter. So the point is that when you do this classification of genes according to the way they respond to infection, the software, the Kohonen classification algorithm basically give you these patterns. They are genes that were not activated in the non-inoculated plants. They get activated by the ancestral, and they get further activated by the evolved. These are upregulated genes. Downregulated genes are here. So genes that go down and then further down. And genes that, these are particularly interesting cases of genes, those here, because are the most common patterns, are these two here and these two there, which basically are genes that were not activated by normal plants, non-infected plants, they were down regulated by the ancestor or activated by the ancestral, and then go back to the non-infected situation by the evolved. This is the complementaries. Okay, genes that were up activated and then they are down, genes that were up activated and they are down. So basically, together all these genes are those that the ancestral virus or the plants turn on when detects the ancestral virus, but it's not turning on when detecting the evolved virus, or maybe not even detecting the evolved virus, I don't know. But they are not expressed when the evolved virus is infected, and they were expressed with the ancestral virus. I don't know what I did. Okay, yeah. So,
sure. To what extent, I find it a bit difficult to choose the right tissue for comparison and the right developmental stage.
Me too.
So what is this confounding your pattern?
I know. I mean, this is a leaf tissue, and it's systemic leaf tissue. And it's basically, you try to take always the same leaf in all the plants, and I know. I mean, if we look in flowers, probably will be something different. If you look in the root of the plant, will be different. If you do a pool of everything, it will be a kind of average. So, I know.
But what happens if you have these? I don't know. There are various ways to get these stunted plants. So my thing is, maybe you get very similar response when you just use plants that are stunted in another way, rather than being a virus response.
I give you that. Yeah. It might be.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. No. It's true.
So, these ones that are upregulated or downregulated in the ancestral virus tree.
But not in the evolved.
But not in the evolved Formosa, do you think this is an indication of some sort of immune response that gets shot down by the evolved virus or something?
So when you do go turns, when you see functions rather than genes, I mean 300, 600 genes, it's just too messy to take on nothing. So when you do these things, these are the functional categories that explain that difference, that are overexpressed on the ancestral, but they are not in the evolved. And when you look what is here, is some categories, but just look at the ones I highlight. Response to hormones. Hormones are the molecules that serve as messengers in the plants to tell the plant what to do in certain cases. Cell-to-cell signaling, response to infection. I mean, bacteria is because somebody did with bacteria, but it's response to infection. Signaling, resistant, and immune resistant. So basically, the difference are, or among this list of categories, there are at least 3-4 categories involved in signaling, and 3-4 categories involved in response to resistance. In plants, the systemic acquired resistance is basically mediated by hormones, and is when you get a cell that is infected, it starts sending signals to the neighboring cell, kind to prevent them. That's an infection coming, okay? So the cells get in a stage of kind of predisposed. And in some cases, the extreme case is when they produce necrosis. So they basically kill themselves as apoptosis, they kill themselves and isolate the first or the second or the third, but a group of cells. And the innate immune resistance is RNAi, basically, okay? So the ancestral virus, the plant detects somehow the infection and responds with signaling and triggering immune responses, whereas with the evolved virus, it's not. And our interpretation is that they do this thing so fast, they start spreading so fast, that they go one step ahead of the plant at every moment. So they go faster than the plant is able of responding.
So for plant to flower fast and at earlier stage, is it active response of plant to avoid being killed before it can put seeds out, or it is due to low resource availability? Because a strategy of just accelerating and producing before you are killed is quite common, like desiccation, stabilization, you name it, right?
Sure.
And related questions, and if this is what plant is doing in response to viral infection, I could envision scenarios where in nature it would actually be beneficial for a plant to be infected early on. For example, it comes to salinized patch, and it is accelerated by virus, and that prevents it from being killed by buildup of salinity over a season, something like that.
So, going to the first question. I think this will be more like, the plant has to divert the resources. It has a number of resources, and either it goes to defense or it goes to producing flowers and reproduction investment. And it does that way. So it's not a tolerance mechanism in that sense. So the tolerance means that the plant still is able of growing with the virus inside.
Oh, in this case, it could be escape mechanism.
Yeah, it's an escape mechanism rather than a tolerance. Yeah, right. So I guess it's that. We are not really getting into the molecular physiology details of the things. Okay, we are more interested on the virus side or on the plant side. But we never really got into much on this. But the second in the ecology context, I mean, absolutely right.
And it would be actually quite cool because the virus exists within some patch of environments, right?
Yeah, it does actually. Yeah, so it might be a way of making the plant flowering early in season and then give you an advantage compared, especially because these other viruses might transmit vertically through the seeds, but this is not the case with that one. So if they produce seeds early, even if they produce less seeds, which is the case.
But could they be acquired from soil?
No.
So
they need a vector.
It is direct transmission?
The vector. It is a vector. So we did lots of things, and one of the things we did was, this is kind of a bit what, I don't remember who was the other day talking about, mapping on the network of regulatory interactions where these genes are. And basically we did that. This is the network of regulatory interactions for the whole Arabidopsis thaliana. This is a model, it's just a model. There are a few models of this in the internet and the databases. We just use one. And the network has a number of properties. It's a scale-free network and all these things. And basically we made the following thought experiment. So you have the network, and you know that some genes are going to be altered by the virus. The question is, and then you do connectivity plot. Here you have connectivity, and then the probability of certain connections per node. And in red, what you have is the power law for the entire network, okay? In red, like the dot reds here. So you have the entire network. And then the question is, we argue, so if the virus is preferentially altering the expression of genes that are in the periphery of the network, there will be less connected genes. So if you take the virus-affected genes and you make this plot, you will find something with a steeper slope. So less connections will be more common, whereas high connected nodes will be less common. This is one possibility. The other possibility is here, is that the virus preferentially manipulates or alters, or the plant manipulates or changes the expression of genes that are central in the network. Okay, very highly connected genes. If this is the case, then you expect a slope which is flatter than the slope for the entire network, because the subset of genes will be highly connected. Okay, these are predictions. How do the data look like? Here you have, in dark blue, is the network, the connectivity of the network, the plot of connectivity. In light blue, you have genes that are altered by the ancestral virus, which is steeper. Okay, so they are like somewhere in the network, but not particularly well connected. Whereas the evolved virus is here in red. The line is a bit like that, no? But you have the red dots here. This is the best fitting line. which is compatible with this thing here. So it's like the genes that have been altered upon infection with the Ebola virus are more central, more connected than the genes that were activated by the ancestral virus. What that means? Well, really, I mean, it's like hub genes or signaling. Central genes in the signaling pathway probably are somehow altered by the virus in a way that results in what we observe. But highly speculative. Okay. And this is coming slowly to what Christian asked before. Are the other ecotypes of the plant accessible to infection? So we have done this experiment in a particular ecotype, which we know was susceptible to systemic infection. What happened with other ecotypes? So we took a collection of them. Here they are. It's a number of ecotypes. Basically everything that was in my institute. So in green, I'm showing you those that were susceptible to infection by the ancestral. Okay, here. Lancelot erecta, we know. And Stockholm zero, that's another ecotype that is also susceptible. This was supposed to be susceptible. We couldn't infect it. And then we did the infection experiment with the Ebola virus. And yeah, basically everything can get infected. Now, there are some things that are really poorly infected, like 7%, 9%, or 7%, 6%, 9%. But others, like this guy here, 23%, 50%, 42%. So some of them are really well infected now. So this was a message basically for plant pathology. So when you define something that is resistant against a virus, you should be careful. You should not be saying that it's resistant to a virus. It's resistant to a particular genotype of the virus. Maybe there are other genotypes that exist in nature or not, that are able of going through that resistance, so specific resistance, and infect the plant. Indeed, the symptoms, I mean, you see symptoms of all types. So you have mild symptoms, like this guy here, or this guy here. There's always the control and infected. You see some mild symptoms. You see intermediate symptoms, like this, or this. And you really see severe symptoms like these guys here. So there's a variety of symptoms and a variety of responses to infection. But this variety of responses to infection to this TB17 virus, AT17 virus, is basically, it correlates with the response of the plants to infection. Basically, when you do the transcriptomics of these infected plants, again, using the Agilent chips, you see kind of two groups. The plants, the response to infection basically groups according to the symptoms that you see. So they are a group of severe plant or severe showing plant like Lansbury, Stockholm, and D. So here they are, Lansbury, Stockholm, where is D? It's not here. And there is a group of mild plants, A, OI, and WT, OI, and I don't know where is WT, it's not even in this small picture. Okay, so the transcriptomic responses basically are telling us that there are differences in symptoms. You can do functional categories, and basically there are a group of categories that are typical of group 2, and these categories are in basically metabolism, whereas there are a group of categories typical of group 1, remember the severe ones, that are more related with defense responses. Okay, and a bunch of things in the middle that are altered by both. So they have different responses. The ecotypes respond differently to infection of this virus. So some are more resistant, some are less, some produce less infection and a mild response, whereas others produce a strong defense response and the virus does not accumulate well. So this variability in the response to infection, both at the level of infectivity and at the molecular physiological response.
Is the variability more or less random, or can you predict it based on the host's relatedness?
That, I try to do that, you know. That was the first thing. See if there is a relatedness in the ecotypes.
Yeah.
But if you go to the literature, I couldn't find any reliable. I mean, even we didn't do that ourselves, of course. But there's no. I mean, basically, how people understand the evolution of variability in Arabidopsis is like after the last age period, it was kind of in Europe. You know, the Iberian Peninsula was kind of reservoir, and everything spreads out of there. And if you look at the phylogeny of things, it's basically, if I'm not saying anything wrong, it's like a star phylogeny. So basically, it was a fast spread of everything. So you have ecotypes that are, but probably there will be some kind of gradient, north, south, but it's not really strong enough as to make clades and say these two respond the same because they are genetically closer than these other two. I mean, this is genetic variability that in principle make them more or less susceptible. There will be lots of genes that are different and might not be involved in response to infection, or who knows. But yeah. So, but that gives us the possibility of doing another evolution experiment in which we take now different ecotypes, which are more or less susceptible. No? This is very poorly susceptible. This is Landsberg. This is Cestisol. These two are really susceptible, and these two are not very much susceptible. So we can take our Landsberg erecta virus, the AT17 virus, and then we can start evolution experiments on each one of these ecotypes and see whether different ecotypes select for viruses which are genotypically different, and how these differences translate into the transcriptomic responses of the plants. No? So we did the evolution experiments, and speeding up a little bit. And basically, after 15 passages, we took and measured, first thing, we measured the fitness of each virus on each particular ecotype. So here is a table with all the fitness values relative to the ancestral. I mean, ancestral now means AT17, not the true tobacco virus. So basically, what you have here are the different lineages, the local host, and the test host. The diagonal in gray is the fitness of each virus on its own local host. Everything outside the diagonal is the fitness on the corresponding alternative. Okay? So they are here. You have they have fitness, basically the good fitness there, and they pay cost. They are not well adapted to other hosts, but they are also correlated, positive correlated responses. So adapting to the new host still has. So to summarize all this information in one figure, basically here you have the average relative fitness in the local host versus the average relative fitness in the unselected host. And basically what you observe here is a negative correlation. When you are really highly adapted in your local host, basically when you have low fitness in your local host, you still retain certain high fitness in the alternative host, but as much you get adapted to your local host, the fitness on the ancestral host is low. So there is kind of a negative correlation here in fitness and also in virulence. The more virulent you get in your local host, the less virulent you are in the alternative host, on the average alternative host, whereas the less or the more virulent you are on average on alternative host means the less you are in your local host. So it's a kind of the trade-off, again, pops up here at the level of differences between ecotypes of the plant, whereas when I started my talk was differences between plant species. This is now looking at differences between, in principle, like individuals of the same species that differ in sensitivity to infection. But forget this. So you can reorganize the data in a kind of a matrix and build a network, an infection network. And basically what the network tells you is that there are certain viral lineages that are generalist. They can infect as good as the local viruses that particular host, so they are kind of generalists, they do well in every host, whereas some other lineages are highly specific of a particular host, and that means that basically, that's it. Okay. So it's a non-modular nested network. So a nested network, a nested infection matrix, tell us something about the way the virus and the host interact. It's a kind of gene-by-gene interaction model. So basically, it's like if the virus is, if the plants are adding like resistant components to the virus and the virus breaks the first resistant, it's able of infecting the first plant. When it breaks the second resistant, it's able of infecting two different types of plants. When it breaks the third resistant, it infects three types of plants, and so on. When you look at the molecular details of this experiment, there is a bunch of mutations. I mean, when you sequence the lineages, the full genome, there is a bunch of mutations. There is 79 positions where you see changes. 62 sites where you see changes, with an average of 2 to 8 changes per lineage. And they are both synonymous and non-synonymous. There is actually a lot of non-synonymous mutations that are kind of fixed. It might be because they were hitchhiked with some beneficial mutation, or because they are beneficial themselves. Okay, that's always that possibility. They are convergent mutations. That means that a particular host genotype determines which mutations you observe in the virus. So the virus fixes the same set of mutations in different lineages. And oops, I don't know what I did. And most interestingly, there are three convergent non-synonymous mutations, which means that you see the three same mutations on lineages that were evolved in D2 or ST0. Okay, so they are kind of mutations that synonymous mutations, but still convergent. There are one that is not the same point mutation here. There is on the same codon different mutations that change the same codon in this particular case. Forget about this. It's about the variability. If you look at the within host variability, so you just basically look at differences on among molecules on the same lineage, by doing cloning and sequencing more things, there is a you can estimate the variability that you have within populations and between populations, and then you can ask yourself whether that variability at the molecular level correlates with variability in fitness, in phenotypic fitness, and yeah, it does. That means that some of the molecular changes we have observed are responsible for changes in fitness. That's kind of normal, or at least you expect that. Something has to make sense in terms of fitness. We make a full analysis of the synonymous mutations, and basically we found, and this is going to be the end, I'm not going to get in the next, we found that some of these codons that we observe as convergent mutations, synonymous mutations, when you look at the codon usage tables of Arabidopsis and tobacco, they are different, so they have some differences, and it turns out that those mutations that we observe as convergent synonymous mutations, they were changing an amino acid, a codon for a given amino acid, from one that is poorly used in Arabidopsis to one that is highly used in Arabidopsis. So that's telling us that, it was selection for improving translation efficiency, maybe. The fact that is that those mutations, they have a measurable fitness effect, and turns out to be the case that they change to a more used codon in Arabidopsis. So that was our conclusion. 2 more minutes. I'm just running, but let me just finish this, otherwise it's kind of an incomplete history. So we did the transcriptomics of all these combinations. So we took every virus on every possible host and did the transcriptomics and see whether we ask ourselves a number of questions. I'm just going to give you here two of the many questions that we ask in that paper. Basically, one is, how similar are the profiles, the transcriptomic profiles of all the lineages? How they classify, how similar they are? That's the first question I'm going to ask. And the second is, if I take the most specialist virus according to that infection matrix, I get the most specialist and the most generalist, how different are the transcriptomic responses of the plant? Okay? Do they respond in similar manners across hosts in the case of the generalist, whereas the specialist does different things in different hosts, or what happened in there? Okay? So to answer the first question, basically we compared the transcriptomes of the everything, every transcriptome against the corresponding controls and make a cladogram, which is using as metric to make the cladogram is the similarity between two transcriptional profiles, the entire profile. And basically what you see here is that the profiles classify according to the host where they have been evolving. So two lineages evolving in Stockholm 0 are more similar on average than to any other of the lineages evolved in any other of the hosts, and that's true for everything. So the host genotype somehow determines, clearly determines, the magnitude and who is changing the expression profiles. And the second question, how different are a generalist and a specialist in terms of the response to of the plants? Here we took the most generalist virus, and what we compare here is the most generalist virus corrected by its own control versus that particular lineage on the local host. So this is the expression profile in the local host, and this is the expression profile for this line in all other hosts. When you do one of these Venn diagrams and you see the host, the responses on the different hosts, basically they do not overlap, or they do not overlap too much. I mean, this is a specific, I mean, this is the difference between these two things. So they are basically looking the same. So the generalist, whatever it does to the plant, it does more or less the same in all plants. Whereas the specialist is the same metrics. The specialist, the number of differences between profiles is quite large. So, for instance, this ST0 virus, when you look at the Lansbury, it does like 300 genes do different things. When you do against A2, like 700 genes do different things. Okay? So, the message is like, or the data like suggests, that a generalist virus is able of, I mean, I'm a virus-centric perspective, of course. The virus is able of doing the same across genotypes, whereas a specialist virus does something in its local host, but it does differently in the other host. It doesn't really understand the different host and is manipulating some other thing. So whatever is different among the host is determining this response. So I'm not going to read these things, and that's all. So yeah, I guess that's enough. Have any question or?
Yeah, I have another question. So you, for these single mutants in the first evolution experiment that you talked about, there was only one that had an effect.
By itself, yeah. On the phenotype.
Do you know whether that was the first one that evolved?
No, I don't know. That's the answer. You know, that's an easy to answer question. It's not the first time I get that question, and it's an obvious question to answer. We have the fossil record in the freezer. We have everything in the freezer. Why we don't do a Illumina sequencing now that is cheap of the entire lineages and track how the mutations fix, in which order they appear, in which order they fix. We have not done that. I know it's I know, but we haven't done that. At some point, at some point we will do. But there's always so many things. Yeah, sorry. I know. No.
More things to be done. Is anybody doing GWAS? Because you have these 1,000, whatever, one exception
species. GWAS is a word that biologists don't use.
But it's very interesting.
You mean in the...
I'm not talking on the host. Because you see the heterogeneous response, like you showed that the different accessions are responding differently. So this is a very easy project.
GWAS.
You have a motivated student doing infections, you have the sequence data, thing, you have your QTLs. So
that's a good one. Yeah. You know, it was a... When we were starting all this thing, it was a guy applying for a postdoc, a Marie Curie postdoc, and he actually wrote that thing. Well, it was related to that, plus doing real introgressions of the Lansbury others just to make a narrow interval. Yeah, he was more interested in the mapping, but he never got the Marie Curie. So, and because I'm not really... I agree. It's an easy. Well, easy. Not to me. I never done that. But yeah, it's an interesting project for sure. Will be relatively easy for someone like you that know how to do it. Not me. Okay, guys.
Let's reconvene in 10 minutes.
Yeah.